This is the takeaway for Monday, January 9th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thank you for joining us today. So here's the Trump tweet that we're following. It's not about Meryl Streep at the Golden Globes. No, this one is from Saturday, and it says, having a good relationship with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. Only stupid people or fools would think that it's bad. Donald Trump continued, both countries will perhaps work together to solve some of the great many pressing problems and issues of the world, in all caps. Now, Donald Trump is not the first U.S. leader to look for a Russia reset. President Obama did it. George W. Bush famously looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw that he had a good soul. That feeling didn't last very long. Donald Trump's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, meanwhile, says we should ignore the tweets and the statements and that we can look into Donald Trump's soul.
You always want to go by what's come out of his mouth rather than look at what's in his heart.
Kellyanne Conway on CNN. In his heart, Donald Trump believes that Russian meddling in the election had, as he says, absolutely no effect on the outcome. And that sounds like Donald Trump peering into the hearts of voters to know what helped them make up their minds. But he's also doubted whether Russia meddled at all.
The Russians intended to meddle, and they meddled.
The Russians are clearly a big adversary, and they demonstrated it by trying to mess around our election.
It's President Obama on This Week on ABC and Mitch McConnell on CBS. Well, a lot of Washington, including the 17 agencies of the intelligence community, disagree with the president-elect. Here's incoming White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, and he said as much on Fox News Sunday.
We have had bad actors, including the Russians. But we also have a problem when we have a major political institution that allows foreign governments into their system with hardly any defenses or training.
Well, Donald Trump says that he's going to formulate a hacking response within 90 days of taking office. Still, Russian hacking has revealed not only vulnerabilities at the DNC, surely, but a U.S. government slow to respond to a growing threat, one that's cheap and easy to use with often little discernible downside for a lot of actors. David Sanger is here. He's national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, Todd.
So you've been writing about the slowness. You call it the analog response to a digital problem. And U.S. intelligence officials were in front of senators last week complaining of the same thing. But what are they really saying? That they want more speed in how to respond to not only hacks, but then the use of this information. But they're also acknowledging that there's a brand new matrix here. It's kind of one where there's low risk but high potential of reward for smaller state actors like in Iran or in North Korea, where there's not a whole lot of downside to trying and trying and trying again.
That's right. We've got two different issues here. Number one is cyber is perfect for broke countries like Russia or North Korea or those that are revenue constrained like Iran. This is cheaper than drones, right? And you can reach across borders and it's deniable. Something we had going against us here was not early detection. In fact, we reported on Friday that with the help of the British, the U.S. was alerted to the DNC hack by the early fall of 2015. But President Obama said he first heard about it in early summer of 2016. The FBI did not escalate this with the DNC, and the DNC didn't even alert its own leadership. So we had months that went by in which the hacking took place, and no one was thinking about a response or even putting together the bigger picture. So the problem here wasn't technological. It was a failure of imagination and a failure of response time on the part of the U.S. government.
Was there a failure of imagination by the time this did surface to the president in the early summer before the election? Because he chose not to respond at that time, of course.
Yeah.
At least
so
publicly.
That's right. He understood what was going on pretty well. He did do a warning in private to President Putin at a meeting they had. They were both attending in China in September. But then they got bollocksed up in another problem, which was that President Obama was concerned that if he publicly called out the Russians and did sanctions, they would respond before Election Day or maybe on Election Day by trying to affect the vote tallies. And secondly, I think he was concerned about appearing to be too political. In other words, doing this to side with Hillary Clinton, which certainly Donald Trump would have accused him of. In fact, even today, Donald Trump makes the argument that this is all about politics and it's all driven by the pro-Hillary camp and so forth. Many Republicans don't agree with him, but that's the case he's making. So I think President Obama, absent a political campaign in which he feared being accused of coming down on one side, probably would have reacted sooner.
David Sanger, we've been having more and more conversations on this show about cyber deterrence and what it means to deter or to disincentivize, I suppose, you know, this type of activity. Do you have any sense that officials, planners, agents within the government are starting to get their heads around what deterrence means in this new age?
Well, certainly there are a lot of academics who've been working on this for a long time, and the NSA has as well. And I think if you look around the country, you've got groups of scholars getting together now to try to figure out how do you deter cyber attacks. Much as in the 1950s, you saw scholars get together to try to figure out how do you deter nuclear attacks. The difference is that almost everything that works in nuclear doesn't work in cyber. They're completely different weapons. The dynamics completely different. The cost basis is different. And of course, with a cyber attack, you can dial it up and dial it down. And what's been fascinating about the North Korea hack against Sony, the Russian hack in this case, and many of the others, is they've been just below that level that would trigger a military response. And so people know they can use this and likely get away with it.
Well, all of this, of course, is taking place in a broth of politics. There's no question about that. So David, can you and I just run a quick kind of political check on the claims that get made after action here? I mean, Donald Trump says over and over that there was absolutely no impact on the outcome of this election. Even Donald Trump's critics in Congress, people like Lindsey Graham, say it didn't change the outcome. That strikes me as a completely meaningless and unknowable statement, any more than saying it swung the outcome. It's just not knowable. That's part of the point, I think.
That's right. It is unknowable. It is true that we've seen no evidence that the Russians hacked into the system to tally the votes. And I think that when Mr. Trump turns out these tweets and makes these statements, that's what he's referring to. What we don't know and will never know is how many people decided not to vote for Hillary Clinton because they read a John Podesta email or they saw the stuff from the DNC or whatever. And would that in the end have made a quantifiable difference? And even the intelligence report that came out on Friday said, we didn't even look at this issue. This is beyond the realm of what U.S. intelligence agencies do. We don't do political analysis inside the United States. So it is unknowable.
And not academic in Europe, which is getting ready for a whole round of elections in Germany and France and already have signs that similar, if not identical, weaponized information use is happening there.
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be a significant issue in Europe. And we've already seen in the German election some of these same techniques begin to come out. I'm sure you'll see it in France. And, of course, we already saw it in Ukraine and the Baltics and so forth.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Todd.
The grim task of looking for answers after a mass shooting is underway once again. Reporters and investigators are now digging into the life and background of Esteban Santiago. He's suspected of opening fire at Fort Lauderdale International Airport, killing five people and injuring at least six others. Santiago is 26 years old, a veteran of the Iraq War, who's been living in Anchorage, Alaska. He'd apparently sought help for mental health problems both after returning from war and as recently as a few weeks ago. And that was all before Santiago allegedly flew to Florida from Alaska with a handgun checked in his luggage and at the Fort Lauderdale airport, went into the bathroom, loaded that gun, and came out firing in the baggage claim area. Santiago is in court today for the first time, at least in this case. David Ovalle has been covering the story for the Miami Herald. David, welcome.
Hi.
What happens in court today with Esteban Santiago?
Well, today Esteban will make his first appearance in federal court. I don't think a whole lot will happen. Usually it's a pretty perfunctory court hearing. He's going to be remanded. He's not going to be allowed out on bond because of the gravity of the charges he's facing, which he could face up to the death penalty if he's convicted.
What do we know about his mental condition, both going back to his return from the war and maybe more importantly for this case, right around the time of the crime?
Well, from everything we've been able to ascertain, it seems like his condition had just deteriorated. He had been involved in some domestic strife living in Anchorage. You know, his family members have said he was just not right after returning back from the war. And then more importantly, a couple months ago, he had walked into the FBI field office in Anchorage, Alaska, and told agents that he had been that voices in his head and the government were forcing him to watch ISIS videos. He, you know, sought some sort of treatment and was treated for a few days, but ultimately was released fine and still under investigation. And to everyone's mystery, he decided to pick Fort Lauderdale to come and open fire.
So talking to the FBI about watching ISIS videos is going to raise their ears up really fast. Do they have any indication of whether that has any connection to any organized terrorism or whether it was just a delusion on his part?
You know, our sources have told us that they have scoured his background, scoured social media, scoured his electronic devices, and have not been able to find any sort of nexus to any organized groups, to him radicalizing himself, anything like that. I think at this point, they're leaning toward him just being a very mentally disturbed person who was having delusions. And that's, you know, that's not uncommon. And unfortunately, it manifested itself in this horrific way.
And what are the questions now about Santiago being able to fly with a weapon? I mean, checking a gun in checked baggage is very common in this country. Lots of hunters and other people do it. But Esteban Santiago was a person who had had weapons confiscated from him in the not too distant past.
Well, there's so many gun issues that are raised by this tragedy. But, you know, really, there was no court that adjudicated him in Alaska as being mentally ill. So there was no real mechanism for him to have his gun taken away or to have to really withhold his gun. And investigators do believe it was the same gun that was initially taken by the feds and by the police in Alaska for a few days before it was returned to him later. And then, of course, he did the airport shooting a couple months after that. So, but there's just no mechanism right now. And politically, I imagine it's very, very difficult to try to establish that in the current political environment.
And David Ovalle, investigators and reporters have also been going back to Santiago's family, who've been talking a little bit about his condition, maybe even his deterioration after the war. What are they saying?
Well, I think everyone seems to agree that he just wasn't right after the war. And at least one family member told us that he had sought the treatment after walking into the FBI office, but he didn't really get any follow-up. So and I think there's going to be a lot of issues just about overall mental health treatment in this country. These, you know, people hear voices and have delusions all the time. And while they don't always happen and finish in this sort of tragedy, it's an issue that it really has been on the forefront and should be on the forefront.
David Ovalle of the Miami Herald. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's not your average house closing, but there is a definite move-in date at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. January 20th is when you hand over the keys at the White House. No questions asked. It's usually a little different for U.S. ambassadors and their families overseas, though. For them, there's often a grace period. Diplomats, you know, might have children in school or personal affairs to wrap up. Well, this time, there's an order from the incoming Trump administration. All politically appointed ambassadors are to step down by Inauguration Day. No questions asked. Inconvenient for many diplomats, but is there an underlying message here? Joining me to discuss the incoming ambassador transition is Ambassador W. Robert Pearson. He was ambassador to Turkey between 2000 and 2003. He's currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, is this an unusual move, the wholesale forced resignation of the ambassador corps on Inauguration Day?
Well, it's common practice for all ambassadors, career and non-career, to submit their resignations effective on Inauguration Day. That's not new. What is new is that all of the non-career ambassadors are asked essentially to vacate their post as of that day. I don't think that's ever happened before.
So when you delineate between career and non-career, you're talking about political appointees or you know, some donor or CEO who might get named ambassador versus a career member of the Foreign Service who rises to the rank.
That is correct.
And why would those two people be different usually?
Well, normally the political ambassadors having been closely connected with the administration in their political loyalties expect to leave their post shortly after the new president takes office. And that's usually an orderly process, and it's considered to be custom and takes account of people's lives, their children, their family conditions, and so on and so forth. And it also gives a sense of continuity to the process, not, of course, the policy, because the new president chooses his or her own policy, but to the process itself. And the career ambassadors, of course, have submitted their resignations, but many of them, most of them, normally would receive word from the Department of State that they would continue in their duty, so, and finish their normal tour of duty, which might be 2 years or 3 years in a post, and then, of course, they'd be succeeded by either a non-career or a career ambassador at that time.
So what does this mean then in the real lives of real people? I mean, ambassadors are fancy people, I suppose, to most of us, but they're real people with real jobs and real lives, you know, in Ankara or wherever they are.
Well, that is true. And it's also a matter of a kind of courtesy. I mean, these people, the non-career ambassadors are, of course, political friends of whoever is the president, but they're also Americans first. And so an abrupt change in the process and an order for an abrupt departure just adds to the sense of uncertainty about this transition. Already have been a number of questions arising from telephone calls to Taiwan, tweets regarding North Korea, China, concerns about burden sharing for NATO countries before they receive American support, the wall with Mexico, immigration policy. There are just a number of questions that have been raised that have caused, I'll say, at least uncertainty in people's minds. And this kind of what appears to be a draconian instruction just adds to that uncertainty, and it's not necessary.
Ambassador W. Robert Pearson was ambassador to Turkey from 2000 to 2003. He's currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Ambassador, thank you.
Thank you.
You've seen the disturbing images of pollution in Beijing, thick gray clouds of toxic smog hanging over the city. Pollution in China is a poisonous danger, but it's also an opportunity, and that's because China has announced it's making a $360 billion push to develop renewable power sources to use domestically, but also to sell abroad. The Chinese government says it's about addressing that stifling pollution problem, but also millions of new jobs, and also competing for a growing international market for renewable technology, which is getting cheaper and cheaper all the time. Sam Giel is here. He's executive director of China Dialogue and a research fellow at the Science Policy Research Unit. Sam, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to speak to you.
So what's the bigger play here for China? Is it a cleaner environment and this gray, toxic fog problem in Beijing and other places, or is it positioning to grab the market in renewable energy over the next 50 years?
It's definitely something of both. There is popular pressure to clean up air pollution in China, for sure. The Communist Party needs that for its own legitimacy. Local government officials will be keen to be seen to be helping to deal with urban air pollution, and it's really been choking over the last couple of months in the north of China. But there is a larger kind of top-down ambition to restructure the Chinese economy away from heavy industry and energy-intensive industries like steel and cement towards innovation and services. And low-carbon innovation, cleaner technologies are a big part of that. So China, I think, sees itself positioning itself to be the leading exporter of these sorts of clean technologies to the rest of the world. And they also see that as part of their energy security strategy. I think they're realizing that rather than be exposed to volatile prices for traditional forms of energy supply, they can actually manufacture energy security by investing in renewables, particularly in solar, where we've seen huge deflation in the cost of solar over recent years, largely thanks to the scale of manufacturing in China.
So $360 billion is the down payment right now. How's the United States doing in these markets, our private companies? The cost of solar is coming down everywhere, and despite debates about climate change and how much coal we're going to burn, that hasn't stopped lots of companies here from competing.
No, I'm sure firms will still see the commercial opportunities in moving away from fossil fuels. If you look at the latest International Energy Agency World Energy Outlook, they're showing that coal is in decline. Coal consumption fell last year for the first time, and that was largely thanks to a decrease in coal burning in China. But they also pointed there to the really unforeseen cost deflation in solar and wind. So, you know, things there are industrial dynamics, economic dynamics that are happening regardless of federal policy in the United States, for example, and firms will see that. And at the same time, you're seeing Chinese companies who are now increasingly well positioned to benefit from those commercial opportunities moving into that space. So there was a recent report from the Institute of Economic Analysis, Environmental Economics and Financial Analysis, that showed that last year, Chinese investment in overseas renewables was up 60% year on year, something like $32 billion in renewable energy and related technologies. So we're seeing Chinese companies well positioned to benefit from that. US companies, of course, many of them also are, but you know, they're going to be looking for consistent policy support from government.
What does this analysis that you're delivering for us here say about the promise in this country and our politics right now that thousands or tens of thousands of coal jobs are coming back? I mean, you're talking about a world market in decline and the rise of cheaper renewable alternatives. What does it say about the politics of coal here?
I think it shows that for most observers now, coal really is in decline. Very august financial institutions, international organizations, energy watchers will tell you that coal is in structural decline. It's in terminal decline. And I think China's seen the writing on the wall in that respect. They understand that climate mitigation is not just about averting the likely kind of disasters that come with the increasing climate change and with those sorts of vulnerabilities to the environment, but also it's about ensuring energy security, it's about moving to a position of technology leadership, and it's about benefiting from the low carbon transition that's taking place around the world.
Sam Gill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sam Gill is Executive Director of China Dialogue. He's a research fellow at the Science Policy Research Institute. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Rutland, Vermont is a small place, about 17,000 residents or so, with plenty of problems now all too familiar to many towns in New England. There's opiate addiction and the crime that comes along with it that top the list. It's a huge challenge for the town. It's been complicated now by the arrival of about 100 Syrian and Iraqi refugees. The majority of Rutland residents seem to be for taking in those refugees, but not everyone is. The town's been divided, at times bitterly, and critics say Rutland needs to worry about its own problems before helping others, and that anyway, the whole thing should have been put to a public vote. Meanwhile, the mayor of Rutland is an enthusiastic supporter of welcoming those refugees to his town. Mayor Christopher Lewis says to him it's about compassion, but also about economics.
We have, frankly, a moral obligation to do the right thing for people who are fleeing for their lives and are looking to rebuild those lives. But there is also a pretty significant self-serving component as well. Frankly, we're less than 16,000 now, according to the U.S. Census, and we recognize that embracing new Americans, refugees, immigrants, is a way to reverse that demographic.
Well, how would you characterize just how divided your town has been over this issue?
I'd characterize the division as a very vocal, if not vitriolic, minority. But the level of support, the level of community engagement in welcoming the refugees, welcoming the new Americans, really eclipses and dwarfs the level of the opposition.
Well, let me play you some statements from a guy in your community, Dr. Timothy Cook. I'm sure that you know him. He's an opponent of this plan. He gave an interview, and I wanted to add it to our conversation here.
Between the economic issue, the crime issue, and the drug issue, this is why this city was passed over, not just once, but twice. And yet, somehow, we ended up being required to accept these individuals. You can't rescue a drowning person with a lifeline if you have no lifeline to throw in. We do not have a lifeline at this point in time.
Now, Mayor Lewis, you said the vitriolic opposition has pretty much evaporated recently. You know, I have to tell you that we tried to get two Rutland residents of opposing views onto our show. Nobody wanted to sit down with somebody from the other camp and talk on the air about it.
Well, I've sat down with individuals from the other camp, if you will, in the past, in this very studio, and talked about it. One of those individuals who I had hoped to speak to was the person who just quoted there, Dr. Tim Cook, who I grew up with and went to high school with, graduated with. And I know Dr. Cook. I know Timmy. And frankly, some of the issues he was talking about there, frankly, the false narratives that we've been insistent in trying to dispel with facts, with data. We have an unhealthily low unemployment rate in the city of Rutland at 3.6%. We've got the business community, the Chamber of Commerce, the Rutland Economic Development Corporation, as well as the state of Vermont Chamber and Economic Development leaders championing refugee resettlement for the state of Vermont and for the Rutland area as a means to fill the vacant jobs that are creating problems for economic development within the state.
Still, Dr. Tim Cook, Timmy Cook, as you call him, says that the residents should have had at least an opportunity to weigh in.
If he had opened up a dialogue right from the get-go with the community, I think we might have arrived at a crossroads where we could have accepted some refugees, but not in the manner that they've been accepted now.
Yeah, let's be clear. While there have been some stumbles by Americans in the past when individuals are trying to leave war-torn Europe, specifically the Jewish community, with the internment of Japanese, pretty much America gets it right. We don't get to vote on who our neighbors are. When my grandparents came over from Greece, nobody got to vote on those individuals coming from Greece, from Sicily, from Italy, from Poland. That's not who we are as a country, and that's not who we are as a community. We don't get to vote on who our neighbors are. Now, to the point or the assertion that this was a unilateral decision, that's just false as well. Without the support of the education community, the superintendent and her team saying we can do this, we wouldn't be able to pursue this initiative.
What has this debate done to the fabric of your town? You mentioned vitriol early on, but what about now?
This may be in this sense, somewhat of a pejorative term, but the community has resigned itself to the fact that this is going to happen. And supporters, who've always been supportive since the initial announcement, are extremely excited, engaged to see it succeed. And since the announcement by Department of State, those individuals who are healthy skeptics, those individuals who have reservations, also recognize the importance of seeing this program succeed.
You know, this election season has seen rises in hate crimes and expressions of xenophobic and racial animosity around this country. You're the mayor, and I wonder if you fear the potential for reprisals.
That's a great question. And in my town or the surrounding towns, not a bit. That's not a concern whatsoever, because that's not who we are as a community. This issue is going to define who we are as Rutlanders. And frankly, if there's any indication that there will be any hostility meeting the new Americans, I believe the community will rise up as one, skeptics and ardent supporters alike, and say, no, that's not who we are. Those are not the values and the standards of this community. We will welcome them.
So where do you think this will be in a year? Where do you think your town will be in 1 year?
Well, I think we're going to have a few really fantastic Middle East restaurants, first of all, and that's we all giggle when we say that, but I think the Syrian community specifically is a community and a culture of small entrepreneurial business people. That's the type of infusion we need into our community.
Great Middle Eastern food sounds fantastic, and it's not an easy question, Mayor, but are the residents of Rutland also ready for a new mosque somewhere in town?
Absolutely. We have to look to our past to inform our future. And 150 years ago, those same questions were being asked about Catholic churches. 100 years ago, those same questions were being asked about synagogues. Are we ready to embrace new religions? And the history of our community, the history of our nation is absolutely yes.
Mayor Christopher Lewis is the mayor of Rutland. Sir, thank you so much.
And thank you guys for having me.
A wall along the southern border of the United States with Mexico was one of President-elect Donald Trump's biggest campaign promises. In fact, it's a promise he made at the very start of his campaign.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Yeah. Mark my words.
Yeah. Lines like that for Donald Trump got him a lot of cheers at his rallies, but you didn't hear much from people right along the border, the people with backyards who would have such a wall run right through them.
For a lot of these folks, and this is sort of always the story of border and border security, a lot of these policy decisions that are made elsewhere, namely D.C. and on campaign trails, I mean, affect their livelihoods.
Travis Bubinik is a reporter with Marfa Public Radio, and he visited Presidio, Texas. That's a town of sprawling cattle ranches right along the Rio Grande. And he talked to property owners there who realized that a border wall might be a reality for them and their land.
In this area of far west Texas, in this borderlands area on the river, people are farming in the desert using the river. And so if they can't get to the river, if they can't have access to water, they obviously can't continue farming. So, I mean, the prospect of a wall is a very sort of existential concern to them. And that's something that I talked to with one farmer near Presidio. His name is Terry Bishop.
And there are a lot of people up north who've never been down here, don't have a clue, don't really care either. But they just feel if there's a wall there, then the problem is solved. And I believe that the issue is more complicated than that.
Well, Travis, there's Terry being pretty clear about a debate that takes place, you know, in the halls of power or in front of the cameras that doesn't have a whole lot to do with his farm right where the wall might cut through.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing about Terry is that he's a very realistic guy, and he understands that this is a huge issue that's far out of his control. So he sort of hopes that at a bare minimum, if this wall comes through his property, which is an idea that he mentioned to me has been, you know, tossed his way before, you know, a few years ago, post 9/11, that they will at least ask him what his needs are, what his concerns are. He hopes that they will at least get into the nitty gritty of how he's going to access the river. But when you come right down to it, I mean, he's very frank about the fact that he thinks Trump is going to build a wall. It was a huge campaign promise. He thinks there's no way that he couldn't build a wall. He just has no clue, like most border residents, and I mean pretty much like everybody, I think at this point, where that will happen.
But what does a guy like Terry Bishop, who has all of his water concerns, his farming concerns, his ranching concerns, feel about the immigration concerns? I mean, is this a case where Terry Bishop says we really have to stop folks from Mexico and Central America coming across here, or that's kind of someone else's problem?
A guy like Terry Bishop, I think, is a unique case because he lives in a part of the border that is not the most active immigration corridor in Texas or across the Southwest. He just feels that here, that kind of very intense solution to an immigration problem, it just doesn't add up with the reality on the ground that he's seen throughout his lifetime here.
You know, and I don't know. I understand that there's a lot of border concerns and this, that, and other. I understand that. And then there's the drugs, and I understand that. But there's certain things that I just can't get my arms around the idea of building a wall through Big Bend and through this Big Bend State Ranch here down towards Lajitas. That's just simply too beautiful to put a wall. I can't even imagine how much something like that would cost. And I just don't know that a wall really, especially in an isolated area, is going to work because there's too many ways to get over, under, or through a fence if nobody's watching, you know.
Do local officials or people in government have anything to offer folks like Terry when they have these questions?
I think a lot of local officials across the borderlands, particularly in Texas, I mean, you're talking about blue counties in a red state somewhat, feel like they do speak out about their concerns and their needs and their opinions on ideas like a wall, on ideas like, you know, getting rid of NAFTA or altering it too. But a lot of the times I think they feel like they're just not heard. I talked to the mayor of Presidio, Texas, John Ferguson, and he talked about how he's tried to make a case before that the wall's not the solution, but nobody's really listening.
I'm gonna tell the truth. I really feel powerless when I think about the bigger picture of what's going on in the country and what's being said. I feel pretty powerless.
When he says powerless, I mean that sounds like a small town mayor who sees a big national debate about immigration that really doesn't have a whole lot to do with somebody like him and his constituents on the very front lines.
You know, I don't think it's so much that as that I just think that it's a debate that won't let him into it in some ways. I mean, he talked at length about how he has very nuanced understandings of why immigration is happening. You know, I mean, there's violence in Central American countries, and that story has been covered and that story has been told. But he just feels that, like, people don't often come to the borderlands and ask what his solutions to those problems would be. And his solutions are he's a Democratic mayor. They are very neighborly toward Mexico, and they are not favoring ideas like building a wall. And he thinks there are other ways to go about this. But his sort of main takeaway about these national debates about immigration and border security and how they affect his town and his community is that he really just wishes people would listen more.
So, Travis, as we've watched this debate unfold throughout the campaign, immigration, the wall, a lot of people said, oh, just a big blustery promise from Donald Trump. It'll never get built. The people who you talk to don't believe that, right?
They sort of have no other option but to assume that it will happen and that it could happen to them. I mean, because listen, if you got property on the river, you got a farming operation, you're, you know, doing your budgets for the year and things, you have to consider those things. And with such a huge campaign promise, when your livelihood depends on having access to the Rio Grande, like, you can't just say, oh, it probably won't happen. You have to at least respect the possibility that it could. I think that's where they're at.
And based on your reporting and what people are telling you, Travis Bubinick, I can't imagine that anybody really cares about the second part of that promise. We're going to build the wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. That second part doesn't sound like it matters much to people.
It hasn't come up that much. You know, I mean, I don't know every single border resident's politics, and they can be somewhat complicated. But I mean, that is not something that, if you are faced with the prospect of a concrete structure, a wrought iron structure, whatever, fence, wall coming through your property, I don't think your concern is necessarily who's going to pay for it, but whether or not it's going to happen and what you are going to do about it.
Facing the prospects of a border wall along the border itself in Presidio, Texas, MARFA Public Radio reporter Travis Bubinick, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks.
Travis Bubinick is a reporter at MARFA Public Radio in Texas. His report is featured today in The Wall. That's a special hour-long program from the Texas Standard. For more, you can visit texasstandard.org. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. We've been sharing a series of conversations with you over the last few weeks, hosted by our friend Rebecca Carroll. Rebecca is a special projects producer for WNYC Radio, and she's Black, but her identity is actually more complicated than that.
I am adopted. I was adopted into a white family.
Well, Rebecca doesn't speak a lot publicly about her adoption story, but then last summer, a group called PACT that specializes in interracial adoption called her up and asked her to speak, and she agreed, if reluctantly.
I just thought, like, if my parents had had an opportunity to go to a conference with interracial families and white parents mostly of Black and brown kids and shown me that kind of investment, I really so would have appreciated it. And so I thought, okay, let me do this.
She did it. And at the conference, Rebecca met actress Kristen Davis. You might remember her because she played Charlotte in Sex and the City. Kristen Davis was at the conference because a few years ago, she adopted a Black child, her daughter Gemma. So Rebecca sat down with Kristen Davis to talk about their experiences with interracial adoption. And it didn't take long before Kristen Davis became emotional about just how much responsibility she has to her daughter.
I am white. I have lived in white privilege. I thought I knew before adopting my daughter that I was in white privilege and that I understood what that meant. But until you actually have a child, which is like your heart being outside you, and that heart happens to be in a brown body, and then you have people who are, you know, actively working against your child, it's hard. It fills me with terror.
Do you feel like... I mean, I feel like the lens, our lenses as women, as mothers, as creators, thinkers, whatever, the entire lens has shifted. Did you ever think, what were you thinking?
We have a really intense and wonderful adoption community of interracially adopted, you know, families. And some of my friends are directors and very creative people. And we do engage in magical thinking. It's part of what we do, you know, and that can lead to problems. Absolutely. When you're living in the real world with your children, I think that we want to make it all good. And, you know, then you start to be slowly stripped away of the fantasy of that and come into the reality of that. And then you just have to work harder. I don't know if that made sense.
It does make sense. And it reminds me, though, of a conversation we had at PACT where, you know, there were a couple of other folks from the Hollywood community. And I had said, I don't know if I articulated it in this way, but y'all have adopted black children, so I imagine that you are about racial justice. And so why do I not see you, you know, out there on your platforms talking about racial justice? And do you remember what you said?
I don't. What did I say, Rebecca? Please tell me.
I don't know that it had occurred to me. I think you said that.
I think that's true. I think that's true. Because, yeah, I just it's a strange thing where you don't necessarily put it all together. I don't know how to put it that way. You know what's inside you, right? And I know my own life, and I know what I saw growing up. I might be working in my own way that might not be so obvious. But then as a white person, and I think we talked about this, right? You then somehow feel like, oh my God, am I allowed to do it? Because yes, I have adopted this black child, which some people know and some people don't, because I try to keep her out of the spotlight. But like someone the other day on Twitter said something like, you know, well, what do you know about it or something? And I was like, oh, God.
Well, you were like, I know a lot about it or somewhat about it. I mean.
Right. See, that's where you get into the toughie. I do and I don't. I mean, I'm on the intense learning curve because I have to protect my child.
So speaking of language and the role that you're best known for. And that I didn't watch it for that very reason, that I felt that there was not a person or a situation that reflected my experience. And also the other thing is that growing up in a white family, in a white town, in white schools, you know, the one thing that I really struggled with was the standard of beauty, right? Who was chosen and who was not chosen. And so, you know, the day that Gemma watches Sex and the City, what do you say?
I don't know if I can say what I'm going to say publicly.
Oh.
Because you know that we tried behind the scenes. And I don't want to say anything negative because I care about everybody involved. But, you know, we weren't as successful as we wanted to be. But we did try. I would say something to that effect because it's true. And I would say, I'm sorry.
And how do you talk to her about her beauty?
My child looks beautiful and fantastic in her camo outfit and her mohawk and her everything. I always tell her that because I have to tell her that. I have to tell her your curls are beautiful. Your black skin is beautiful. You're beautiful. You're powerful. You're a goddess. And you've seen her. She is.
I mean, she certainly is. But at the same time, she's looking at you and she's like, well, mommy, you're white and you look like everybody that I see on TV or in magazines or whatever, you know. I mean, not that she looks at magazines.
No, because we work really hard at that. That's one area, I think, because of what I do, that I was really hyper aware of. Because I know what I grew up looking at in the magazines, and I felt less than, you know, because that's what they want you to feel. So, like, you know, Serena is a household fixture at our house. This is a funny thing I went through, too. I think I told you that we had gone to this school near my house as a preschool that was like this hippie preschool. It was a co-op. It was like very granola, LA granola, you know. And we go, and I'm like, oh my God, they're all blonde. Like, literally blonde. Like, there's like nobody of anything, really. And then I would talk to the teachers, and they say, oh, they don't know. They don't know. And it was good, though, because it was a way wake-up call for me. Because I thought, it's hippie, it's love. You know, the Pollyanna thing that we white folks do sometimes. So anyway, we're there, and, you know, some bullying happened with this one child who would systematically save the swing and not let my child on it, even though my child was waiting. And then she would hold it. She would say, I'm holding it. And she would call different white girls to come be on the swing. So this got to the point where I ended up in the office screaming like a crazy, crazy person because it never was handled. It was never handled with that one particular child. And they said to me in the room, they said, well, you know, it's not racial. And I was like, well, look, I did not ask that girl what it was about. And I did not ask my child what she thought it was about, but I can guarantee you at some point my child is going to internalize that as being because she looks different. And there's a lot of studies that say that at this age, they're sorting things. We all teach them to sort the colors and sort the shapes. And why wouldn't they be sorting who looks like who on the playground? And if you're the only one, you know this, obviously. You've lived it and also told us about it at camp, but you know, it was terrible. And they were like, oh no, no, we just love them all the same. And I was like, we're out of here, bye bye. And that was what set me on the thing of like, I don't want to swear the way I want to swear on your show. But I mean, you know, it really was a very frightening wake up call of the kind of systematic under the covers type racism that's happening at all times.
That's actress Kristen Davis in conversation with Rebecca Carroll, special projects editor at WNYC. If you want to hear their full conversation, you can get it on our website at thetakeaway.org. Well, earlier in the show, we talked about one small Vermont town that's having a debate over accepting 100 Syrian and Iraqi war refugees. 65 million people are displaced and looking for new lives away from poverty and war worldwide. And we've been asking you if your community is open to helping settle refugees.
My name is Jonathan from Beaverton. I am against resettling refugees in my town. I saw this happen when I was a kid with Somalian refugees. The area was nice and has since turned into a slum, and I would never move back to that same area.
That's the kind of debate that was taking place in Rutland, Vermont, that plays out all over America. We got this from Wallbridge, Washington. I would love to see refugees settled here in Seattle, and I think the community would be mostly welcoming. You can call us at 8778-MYTAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. We always want to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.